The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Glad you can join us today. I've got Jim coming on in a moment. I will say that I just spent a few days in Asheville, North Carolina, my first visit to that area of the country, and had a very pleasant time. And have very positive things to say about that area. Flew into Charlotte and made the drive, so got to see a little bit of the scenery, which of course is people who are have visited or are from that area of the country, same way up in the Ohio, Kentucky area as well, at least in my experience driving through. You see an awful lot of trees, which coming from out west here, we certainly have trees, but it's a different type of a experience than the trees back east. So I kept yearning for, it'd be nice if I could see out and see some stuff. But I was expecting that because, like I said, I've spent a little time in Ohio, Kentucky area as well, and I had the same experience when I was there. The one thing that was a little surprising is it was only 65 or 70 degrees. I thought it was going to be more like 85 degrees, which is typical for this time of the year, but there was a cold spell, so it was kind of drizzly and no real heavy rain when we were there, but it was overcast and drizzly for a couple days. The last day we were there was a little bit nicer, so but really had a nice time in Asheville, and didn't get to see a ton of stuff because we were only there for 3 days, but what we did see, really enjoyed it. Wouldn't mind going back there sometime. So want to thank everybody out there who provided such a pleasant experience while we were there. Jim is back in Colorado now, so he made it safely back from Ohio. I'm sure we'll get a recap in a moment about how his journey went back from Ohio, and if he's got anything new to share.
I did not know that's actually where you went. And when you were sharing, I guess I should pay attention to you more often. When you were sharing that, I thought you were going to be complaining about the humidity. But the wonderful weather the last week I was in Ohio, I guess, made it all the way to North Carolina for what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, it was – I don't mind the humidity when it's 70. It's not that bad. And my skin, you know, is in really good shape now.
For the record, Chris, it's not the humidity that you're bitching about. It's the dew point.
So, yeah, if we don't want to get technical.
That's what it is. It's the dew point.
I think I call it the sweat factor. If I'm walking around comfortably outside and not sweating, it's not too bad.
My old weather app, when you clicked the dew point, I don't remember what app that was. Mm-hmm. It had little sweat emojis to show you how bad the dew point was.
Nice.
There was a smiley sweat emoji where he was smiling because it wasn't bad. And then there was another one where it's just like the emoji itself looks just like a big water droplet.
Yeah, I prefer the smiley style.
But I will say The weather the first week that I was in Ohio was hot and humid. But, and this is honest, Chris, I would go out on the deck and I went outside and I was going shopping and doing it. I mean, because I got an apartment I got to fill. So I was out a lot in it. And I really do feel, especially if my garden is semi-shaded, I could work in it. But there was no way in heck I would be able to hike in it. It was just too much. And I was talking to a friend I hiked with on Saturday, and he had gone hiking during the week. And I was like, no, I got to work. And he said he had a, like, literally, he didn't, but he said, I should have just cut my T-shirt to take it off because it did not want to come off me. It is, you would have hated that.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you didn't experience that, which was the first week I was in Ohio. The second week, oh my goodness.
I don't know
if this was throughout the whole Midwest and into the western part of the East Coast where you were in the western part of North Carolina. But the weather was only in the high 70s, low 80s with dew points in the 50s. It was beautiful. I mean, just gorgeous. But all the locals were warning me that, no, Jim, this if this was the norm, nobody would leave Ohio.
Yeah, for sure.
This is the abnormal. So we get a break like this throughout the summer. But what you experienced the first week you were here is more representative of July and August.
Right before we got to Asheville, they were really hot too. We just happened to miss it. And then it warmed up a bit before we left, and it was noticeably warmer yesterday. We just came back yesterday. So it Thursday was yesterday, for those of you keeping track. And
I literally just got back yesterday as well. I got in at DIA. What time did you land at DIA? I landed at 4:30.
I came in about 5:45.
Yeah. Okay. Not too far apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's good to be back.
Hot. Hot here.
Oh my Lord. I was going to say it's good to be back in the oven, otherwise known as the arid west.
But it's a dry heat.
Oh yeah. So is my oven, but I don't sit in it. It is hot. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. Yeah. Bone dry and hot. And for some reason, weeds, at least Colorado weeds, they're immune to this stuff.
I don't understand how they cannot take some kind of gene combination and put that into Kentucky bluegrass, and we could then have lawns the way we want them without all the water. I cannot believe weeds can
grow. Why can't they do that? I mean, they can make all this genetic food stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Maybe it's the lawn care industry that, you know, Big Lawn is fighting it.
Maybe.
Because let me tell you, folks, I have just this hard, compacted dirt driveway. It's road-based, a road-based, hard, compacted driveway that I wouldn't be able to get any vegetable, let alone Kentucky bluegrass, to grow in. But when I came back, it was like a sea of weeds.
Yeah.
And I normally spray it once a week. I'll walk through and spot spray it with Roundup.
I don't get it.
As the weeds are growing through. But after 3 weeks of not doing it, 3 weeks, folks, of minimal rain. It wasn't 3 weeks of cool, wet weather. It was minimal rain with the last 5 days before I got home in the mid to upper 90s and no moisture. Yet these weeds, unbelievable size.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Chris.
It's crazy.
Why can't we put whatever gene is making these weeds live in barren soil, get it into our grass, and allow me to cut down on all the water I put in the darn grass?
Yeah. That could solve some of our water shortage issues.
It would. If you're a gene splicer out there, stop making food, which a lot of people don't want to eat. Make turf grass, which everybody wants, and nobody does anymore, especially in Colorado because of all the water. I have a very small lawn, and I wish I still didn't have to water it. It's not big at all, and I'm taking a big chunk out next year. I have about 4,000 square feet. I'm going to take out another 1,000, so I'm going to be down to about 3, which is tiny. And it's also, I'll have more water for my garden. But, yeah, if they could do something like that. Okay, I digress. Let's not go down that rabbit hole. People will start sending nasty grams to me again. Anyways, good that you're back. I'm back. I will be here for 5 weeks, folks, and then I will leave for a week in Ohio, and then I will be in New Orleans for a conference. Bob Veras is retiring in 3 years, so I rejoined his group. I had belonged to it years ago. Bob is a talking head in our industry. He never was a practicing financial advisor. He was a reporter for, I think, Financial Planning Magazine back when that was a real magazine in our industry. I could be wrong on that. I forget what magazine it was. Back when magazines were actually magazines and you received printed magazines. But he's kind of a talking head in our industry. I support a lot of what Bob believes in, but not everything. And I thought, well, he announced he's going to retire in 3 years. I thought, well, I'm going to rejoin and go to his conference for the next 3 years because it's a pretty good one. So I will be going to New Orleans, I think around the 22nd of September, and staying there to, I think that's a Monday. I think I fly in on a Monday. Conference is Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and I fly back to Colorado Thursday evening. So I'll be in New Orleans for a couple of days after being in Ohio for about 11. So if anybody's in the New Orleans area, I've never been there, but if anyone's in the area, give me a shout out. Same thing with Ohio, of course. If you're in the Cincy area, give me a shout out and be glad to try to meet people. There is one person who emailed me. I apologize for not getting back to you, warning me about some tennis event up I-71 in the Cincinnati area and to stay away from it. Thank you. I did stay away from that. I know you offered to try to get together. I couldn't, and I apologize for not getting back to you. I will personally reach out to you, and maybe we can arrange a time to get together next time I'm there. But apparently it was a big tennis event. I didn't know that Cincinnati has one. And he warned me to stay away from this area, that the traffic would be an absolute nightmare for 4 or 5 days when this big tennis thing was going on. So it's good that I get the inside scoop from people on where to avoid. Mm-hmm. All righty, well, let's get into the podcast. So we're going to begin with one Social Security question. Then we're going to jump into a couple of annuity questions and some non-annuity questions. So we're going to do one. And this question, Chris, on Social Security is probably less of a direct question and more of something that you and I, to a lesser degree, could run down, that I think there is no right answer to what this person is asking. And you could ask.
Yeah, and a lot of questions about a lot of decisions surrounding Social Security are, there's no obvious right answer. You won't know you were, quote, right until later on, because so much of it has to do with how long you live. And that's an unknown when you're making the decision. So every once in a while, there'll be a fairly obvious answer, but many times there's not an obvious answer. And everyone's circumstances are different. So what's good for one person might be completely different answer for someone else in similar circumstances due to other factors besides Social Security claiming itself. So always keep that in mind. Just because you heard somebody out there, or if there's somebody espousing, you should do this, without, you know, looking into your specific situation, especially all the stuff on social media that they're, you know, claiming you should do this with your Social Security. Oh my gosh, run far away from that, because there's really no obvious one size fits all for people. It really depends on your circumstances.
Well, I think every single Social Security question could be answered easily if you just answer one question to me. Mm-hmm. When are you going to die?
Yep.
You tell me that, I'll be able to answer pretty much any, well, Chris will be able to answer pretty much any Social Security claiming question.
For sure. Let's get into this. Confidence. Yeah.
All right. Hello, Jim, Chris, and team. First, my state hint. I come from the state that lost a border, quote unquote, war with one state, and as a result, gained territory from an adjacent state. I think we had a question similar to this.
We did. And the only reason I have some idea about this is because we did have that, a related question. It wasn't this exact question, but it was that whole, you know, uproar between Michigan and Ohio, which now I forget who, quote, won or what, you know, what happened, but that it explains why, you know, there's that little part of Michigan in the, that upper part, and Ohio got something in exchange, I think, as part of this. But there was a battle over the border between the two states back in the day.
And it's still, yes, because we joked that it continues to this day between Ohio State, or the Ohio State, and Michigan in football.
Yep.
So the answer is Michigan. Both Ohio and Michigan, according to this guy, which was just a territory at the time this occurred in 1835, wanted the land around Toledo. The final settlement gave Toledo to Ohio, but the western upper peninsula went to Michigan. So I wonder if they really would have came to fisticuffs. But anyways, I think we had that question in the past. Uh-huh. All righty. So this is kind of a very long question. I'm going to read quickly through. I don't want to read the entire thing, but it's going to really come down to a big fat, I don't know, but here's Chris's opinion. That's what I think he's going to say. I'm a VG'er and a DIYer who appreciates your insightful approach to retirement planning. I enjoy listening to your podcast for the education it provides and for its entertaining style. You, Chris, and your team are very generous in sharing your knowledge and opinions. Thank you very much, listener. I and Chris and the rest of the team greatly appreciate your kind words. Okay, on to his question. My younger brother and I were on a road trip, and we listened to several of your podcasts along the way. We started talking about his particular situation and his plans for claiming Social Security. In bulleted point, here's just some backgrounds. My brother is unmarried and 66. He will reach full retirement age in August of 25. So that's now. It's August of 25 now. So yep. If it's not happy birthday, it's almost happy birthday for this gentleman. He still works, loves his job, and will plan on continuing to work well past his full retirement age. And when he finally does retire, he will not need Social Security to live on. Very good situation to be in, folks. His current plan is to claim Social Security at his full retirement age. And if you're wondering, folks, how can he do that? Because he's still working. What's the key there, Chris?
Key is once you reach your full retirement age, there is no longer an earnings test applied to Social Security. So your Social Security is not reduced by any potential earnings you have. Unlike in the months prior to reaching your full retirement age, where they do look at your wages from work and will reduce your Social Security benefit if you're collecting, if your earnings exceed a certain amount each year, and that amount changes every year. But for him, once he reaches full retirement age, doesn't have to worry about that anymore.
Okay. So here's his brother's plan. Because he doesn't need the Social Security to live on, I wish he would have mentioned if his brother has people dependent on him. I guess not. But he says, because he doesn't need the money, he's unmarried. So I assume he doesn't have children. I'm unmarried and don't have children. But he could be divorced. Although if he was divorced, he likely would have said his brother's divorced. So I'm guessing this gentleman was a perma-bachelor, much like yours truly, with no children. Or maybe he does have children. We don't have enough insight. But his brother did decide at 67, even though he doesn't need the Social Security, he's going to turn on his Social Security, begin receiving it, and invest it. And his brother did a calculation that if he could live to, and I don't know how he did this, assuming a 5% growth rate, he breaks even at age 88, 22 years from now. And he did give a summary of that. I can forward it to you if you want to see. It's in a Word document. But on to his main question. I, on the other hand, am trying to persuade him that he should wait until 70. This would provide him longevity insurance. He gets longevity insurance, listener and listeners in general. Either way, Social Security itself is longevity insurance. He would get more income, yes. But your brother's situation is intriguing to me. He doesn't need it. He's single. No wife, I'm guessing, ever. And perhaps no children. Similar to me. And I'm actually thinking of turning mine on at 67 as well. Why won't I turn it on at 62, which is now? I'm going to lose it all because of the earnings test. But at 67, I personally don't think I'm going to wait to 70. I've got no one to give my Social Security to. I'm certainly not going to need it because I'm still going to be working. But I, too, will invest it. At the very least, leave it to my niece, my nephew, or a charity.
Yeah, but just think if you're hanging out, if you're hanging out at the bar, trolling for a relationship, what you could
trolling. Is that how you
it's like fishing?
My attempt to find a lifelong someone, trolling.
Yeah,
like I'm
and you your
know,
lure.
Troll, you know,
and-
wait. You know what trolling is? You're scraping the bottom of the ocean floor when you troll.
No.
So you saying I'm just trying to scrape some scrounge up?
You're not.
Is that what you're
implying? No, not the bottom. That's a specific kind. I've trolled with a lure behind a boat in Western lakes here all the time, and it's only down about 20 feet, maybe. So no, it has nothing to
still
do with the bottom
down
of the lake. It
is. You're
trolling is your fishing. Down. It's a fishing reference, which you should get.
No, you're implying right? All the good women are taken. If I was a woman, I would.
There's
be
plenty of fish out there, and. You know what? More are showing up all the time. That's the good news. and part of your little shiny lure you could have out there is, hey, did you know I waited to 70 to claim my Social Security?
Chris, I have a tiny ass Social Security to begin with. You know that.
Yeah, but that so anyways, sounds impressive.
I digress. There's no right answer to this gentleman's question. Let's go on.
Well, I'm talking about you.
Well, people don't want to listen about me. All right. I tried to persuade him that he should wait to 70. This would provide longevity insurance. He gets longevity insurance either way, but he can get more later. Yes, if he waits. But he's that much closer. In this particular case, he's 66 now, so he's going to have to wait. He's not quite having to wait to 67, is he, you think?
I think you said he was born 1959, so he's a 66 yep. and 10-monther.
Okay.
10-monther.
Okay, I sent him the attached article by Wade Fow and Steve Parrish about Social Security claiming strategies. Okay, he goes on, one of the case studies in the article aligns very close to my brother's situation, but the bottom line result was ambiguous, probably because there's no right or wrong answer, right. Listen.
And an unknown mortality age.
Yeah. And an unknown mortality. So what is your opinion of this hardy perennial issue of when someone should claim Social Security? I'm inclined to tell him to do whatever the hell he wants. And I think that's probably the best bet than sticking your nose in. I mean, I mean that with all due respect and politeness and joking. I'm not saying you're purposely sticking your nose in, but let him do what he wants. It would be different if you were sharing with us, your brother does not have a lot of lifetime income. Does not, obviously your brother does. If he doesn't need the Social Security to live on, he either has way more assets than he'll ever spend or a very generous pension or a mixture of both of those where he truly doesn't need this additional stream of lifetime guaranteed income. If he truly doesn't need it, just like I truly don't need my Social Security, for a variety of reasons that I've shared on this podcast, my Social Security is abnormally small. I don't need it at all. And it's making me lean more and more into thinking I will claim it at 67 and start investing it or doing some or spending it. I don't have to invest it. Spend it if I want to. My Social Security payments could be another elk or deer hunt somewhere or a fishing trip. Trolling off the bottom, looking for girlfriends, according to Chris. So that's my personal belief. Could Chris and six other advisors or Wade Fowle tell me I'm wrong and I should do this because academically speaking, I might die with a little bit more money if I just wait and live to this age and break even here? You think I care about any of that? Hell no. I'm looking at and saying, I could use this money now because I don't have a wife dependent on me in this income stream. I don't have children. It's just me. And if I, God forbid, did die before claiming or die probably within 8 to 9 to 10 years after claiming at age 70, I would die leaving money in the pool, if you will. And I would rather start getting it out sooner because, similar to your brother, I don't need it. I don't need the little bit of Social Security I'm going to get is minimal compared to what I will get as a value for my firm and the real estate that I own. That's where the true value of my retirement is going to be, and an inheritance that I may get. But that's how I am going to be funding my retirement, not through Social Security, similar to your brother, who also, by your own admission, doesn't need it. So why not start taking it out sooner? That's my thoughts, but I'll digress to Chris.
Yeah, I think the priorities for how you value Social Security change noticeably when you, quote, don't need it. If it's just extra and you're going to be able to live your retirement life with the comfort and confidence that you would have either way, whether you had Social Security or not, because you have plenty of other resources to satisfy anything you intend to do for as long as you may do it, and have ample contingencies or buffers for things that might come up. If that's the case, that changes, I think, the focus. For most people, though, Social Security is something they depend on to kind of make things work. And in that case, for the majority of people, before I go on to that group, let's comment. I'll just kind of essentially agree with Jim that taking it sooner than later, he says he doesn't need it, but who couldn't use an extra, I don't know, couple $1,000 or whatever it might be a month to go do some fun stuff, even if you're not investing it. That implies you're going to hold it for later, but if you don't need it, who you're investing for is your beneficiaries. Who's going to get the money at the end? I mean, why? I guess if that's your goal, that would make sense. I need to build up a pool for my niece, nephew, charity, you know, whoever I'm going to leave my money to. But if he doesn't need it, just keep in mind, he's not investing it for his own benefit. He's investing it for someone else, because that's where it's going to go. Because if you don't need it, it's going to be there at the end when you die. If that's not appealing to you, I would say take the money and actually use it on yourself. Make some home improvements, deluxe things up a little bit more than you otherwise would. Take an extra fishing vacation or, you know, whatever. Whatever floats your boat, if you will, is probably how I would look at it in a case like this. I would say in a case like this also, looking at the concept of a, quote, break-even point makes a little more sense in my book, because we are dismissing the value of Social Security as longevity insurance. That's an area that we focus on for the vast majority of people who actually need the Social Security to kind of make things work well in their retirement. They need that longevity insurance to give them permission to spend a little more of their other assets on their go-go period or things like that. And in that case, in those cases, which apply to far more Americans, I think, than the I just don't need it group, is that I think you're totally walking down the wrong path with a break-even approach, because you don't know when you're going to pass away. And the risk to retirement isn't dying too early. The financial risks in retirement are living too long. So break-even is almost like you're turning retirement planning into a game. And if you're going to gamify the whole thing, that you certainly have the prerogative to do so. It's your retirement. You can construct it however you want. But where Social Security really shines for most people who, quote, need it, is in its longevity protection. It is one of the few sources of promised, guaranteed by a third party, inflation-adjusted income that's available to most Americans these days. That's a very powerful foundational element to a retirement plan, again, for those people who, quote, need it or could benefit from it. So I would avoid the break-even approach, even though it's commonplace. Why is it so commonplace? Is because it's people like math. They're impressed. They feel like an argument is more robust if there's math involved. And here, I did this math and I solved for this number. He quoted a break even of like 88 or something like that with an assumed 5% rate of return. That's a math problem that you get an answer to with a calculator. Look at this. I used the science of math and time value of money and plugged this in, and here's my quote answer. It's really more about what's it going to do for you during your retirement when you have an unknown length of time in retirement. And so keying it all off a break-even point is undermining, I think, its true power for those who need it in its longevity protection, particularly for people who have someone who's going to inherit their Social Security, in other words, a spouse. In this case, there is apparently is no spouse. But I was joking around with Jim about, you know, maybe wait to claim because maybe you get a future spouse and this could be attractive to them. I think that's something to keep in mind too with this. That would be the argument for him maybe not knee-jerk, you know, turning it on at 67. Is that if he's got any chance of maybe being married to someone that has a much lower Social Security benefit than he has, he would actually be doing that future spouse a favor by delaying if he's the one who ends up passing away first. You know, you can decide whether that's a factor that you want to consider in your decision making or not, but it is a thing. I mean, it is something that you might want to think about. But I would probably lean towards the do whatever the heck he wants to do. If he doesn't need it, what's the harm in doing it sooner versus later? If he's still working, doesn't make much sense to turn it on before full retirement age. But once he hits full retirement age, why don't you take it and do some more stuff for yourself? If there's not a future spouse to worry about, if there's truly no beneficiaries that are going to be affected by your decision, it's all about you, and you really don't need the longevity protection from the Social Security. If that's true, and make sure you've done, you know, looked at it, and that truly is true. Some people think, oh, I've got X number of dollars. That's got to be enough. I'll never go through all of that. Well, they completely, underestimate how much you need over a 30-plus year retirement with inflation factored in and things like that. So make sure it's absolutely true that you, quote, don't need it before you treat it as a low impact decision. That's the only caution maybe I would throw out there. But
That's a justifiable caution, Chris. I would imagine in his brother's situation, mm-hmm. he truly doesn't need it, but one never knows. Yeah. In my case, I truly don't need it, folks. Trust me, I do this for a living. I thought this through and I know what mine is going to be. It's minimal. It'd be about $1,200, I believe. It is not much at all, if that. I think that might even be my age 70 benefit. When I say I don't have much Social Security, I don't for all the reasons I've listed. So I think one of the things that made me smile as you were chatting, I went back and read his email. And after the state hint, it was the answer to this puzzle is right in the first sentence he wrote. I'm a VG'er and DIYer. VGs love trying to crunch numbers when you were getting into that. And to a lot of people, they think the right answer is the one that's going to give you the absolute most money on the day you die. This was what you should have done because you would have had the most money. Sometimes the answer, though, folks, isn't what gives you the most. I don't give a damn on what's going to give me the most money on Social Security. I truly don't. I don't care when the quote-unquote break-even is. I don't care if I die too soon and don't break even. Live such a long time, I quote-unquote come out ahead. I'm looking at just enjoying my final years, trying to keep things simple and straightforward. And to a man who has no wife like this gentleman's brother, I assume no children either, similar to me, no one of importance to leave my wealth to, why the hell do I want to leave it in Social Security if I truly don't need it? Totally different answer as Chris just spent his time remarking on. If you do need it, And you do need lifetime stream of guaranteed income. And every drop of Social Security is crucial. If it's that point, I would go so far as to saying definitely delay, even though you can claim at your full retirement age, delay. Get the delayed retirement credits, get the inflation-adjusted lifetime stream of income, and lock that in. Okay, I think we beat that horse to death. Let's move on.
Sounds good.
Okay. Alrighty, new question of the week. Haven't had an actual new question of the week, or have we? I don't know, but this one is literally a new question of the week. One that made me scratch my head. One that made me sometimes think to myself many a times, damn, I wish I was on those phone calls, just listening. Hello, Jim, Chris, and the Jacobs. I think that's the band you play for now. I think that's etched in stone, Chris and the Jacobs. Oh, wasn't it Chris and J squared? I like Chris and the Jacobs.
That works too.
Yeah, that works. Chris and the Jacobs. Hello, Jim and Chris and the Jacobs. In 2026, that's next year, folks, I will turn 73 and need to start my required minimum distributions. Unless I decide to postpone them until April 1st of 2027. Before you start answering, let me get through this, Chris. Can I do a Roth conversion way early? Well, he didn't put way. I did. I would say wicked early if this was me writing it. Can I do a Roth conversion wicked early in 2026 before I take my RMDs and then take my RMD after I do the conversion in later 2026? Or how about if I delay my RMDs till 2027? If I did this, can I do all this without a penalty? I am aware that required minimum distributions must be taken first in subsequent years. But does it apply to the first year I am required to take RMDs? In 2027, I will begin monthly payments for a qualified income. Well, now he gets into another question. Let's address this first question. So I'm going to skip the annuity part of the question, folks. And I'm going to go to his third paragraph, which ties back into the first paragraph. FYI, for your information, I sent a permutation of this. What the hell is a permutation?
A version of the question.
I also sent that's a big word, folks. Mm-hmm. I'm impressed. I think that's the first time ever. Not only did I say that word on the podcast, we ever received that word on the podcast. I also sent a permutation of this query to Ed Slott, as well as Andy Pankel. Both I respect greatly, because I had three Fidelity advisors assure me that I can do a Roth conversion before my required RMD is taken in the first year if I delay my RMDs to the start of the second year of minimum distributions. My impression is that you can do this under Secure 1, but I think the spirit of Secure 2 says you cannot do a Roth conversion until all of the RMDs have been satisfied. Thank you for the education you provide. Let's answer this first, and then I'll decide if I want to get into his annuity question. Mm-hmm. Listener, I wish I was on the phone where three mm-hmm. Fidelity advisors told you could do what you're trying to do. In brief English, folks, what he's trying to do. Everybody knows in the year you took, right now it's 73. For Chris and I, it'll be age 75. But right now it's 73. He's going to turn 73 in 2026. Everybody should know your first required minimum distribution can be delayed until April 1st, no later than April 1st of the year following the year you turn 73. That is called your required beginning date. We have mentioned the required beginning date many times on this podcast. Just because you delay it does not remove for that first year. He's hoping that first year is a get out of jail free card. If he delays his RMD to April 1st or no later than April 1st of the following year, he thinks that is going to be some sort of get out of jail free card to a very strict rule in the tax code. I call it the first dollar out rule that says in the year. So beginning January 1st of 2026, as we record this, less than five months from now, RMD rules will apply to this gentleman. Mm-hmm. Even if he delays his RMD until as late as April 1st of the year following the year he turns 73, which will be up to April 1st of 2027. It's not a get out of jail free card, though.
Right.
Beginning January 1st, the first dollars out of his IRA will be considered the required minimum distributions. And they, it's etched in stone in the tax code, cannot be rolled over. That's what the tax code says. Tax code doesn't say you can't convert them. It says you can't roll them over. Chris, every conversion is what?
A rollover.
Every conversion is considered a rollover. If the tax code says RMDs cannot be rolled over, Chris, can RMDs be converted?
Absolutely not.
No. And if the tax code also says beginning in the year, you are required to take RMDs. The first dollars out are always considered the RMD. There is no get out of jail free card.
Nope.
Now, I don't know if the Ed Slot Group has gotten back a hold of you on the answer or not. If Andy Panko did, I know Andy will nail this ball. He'll hit this nail right out of the head. I mean, right out of the park. But I'm sure the Ed Slot Group, I don't know if Ed will write back to you himself. So I got a hold of the Ed Slot Group today, and I said, hey, can you just codify this? Give me the language so I can post this. So they did. They sent me the language, and I will put the language in the show notes. And if you, excuse me, it's written in typical bureaucratic double-speak IRC code. But if you read through it, you can clearly see what this gentleman wants to do cannot be done. I'll just put it in the show notes to make this simple. I just wanted to explain. He cannot do it.
Correct.
He cannot do it because of the first dollars out rule.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm hoping the Fidelity advisors of which you speak were people answering the 1-800 number at Fidelity who... And I'm throwing everyone under the bus. The first people who answer the 1-800 numbers, they don't know anything. Who knows how long they've even been working there? They're just typing everything into a computer, trying to get some key answers. They're just flat out wrong. Now, if they were actual people who are helping you manage your money and you're paying Fidelity an asset management fee, which Fidelity does charge, I would look for some new advisors or tell your advisors to start studying this because they're just flat out wrong.
Yeah.
And they would have caused a huge headache if you would have done what they say. Oh, take the RMD first before your RMD. Excuse me. Do the conversion first before your RMD. Yeah. And this will be okay. And if you delay it to 2027, you're fine. If three people truly at Fidelity truly did tell you that, and they're actually holding themselves out to be advisors, they need to go get some better training because they're just flat out wrong. Get back a hold of me if anybody disagrees, or if Andy Panko gets a hold. I could text Andy and see if he answered this gentleman or not.
I'm sure he answered it the same way.
Yeah,
the thing to remember is, the way I always remember to make it nice and clean, is that in a year you owe an RMD, it is owed as of January 1st of that year. It's determined by the December 31st balance at the, you know, a day before January 1st is December 31st. whatever your balance is that year. That determines your RMD for the year in question, and it is due and payable, or due and withdrawable as of January 1st. And then secondly is the first dollar out rule that, that Jim mentioned, that by code, the first dollars out of an IRA when an RMD is due is considered RMD. That's why you don't file anything with the IRS and say, oh, this distribution I'm taking in October, this is my RMD, not the stuff I did before. None of that is ever done. There is no form to do that. Why don't we need that form? Because the IRS has already, you know, Congress has already decided the first dollars out are considered RMD. So as long as you've got withdrawals that year from your IRA that exceed the RMD requirement, it's satisfied. You didn't have to file anything to say you did it and when you did it and all this kind of stuff. So even though they give you in that first year that grace period till April 1st of the following year to take it, it was due and payable January, in his case, January 1 of 2026. That's when it was owed. Any distributions that come out from that account are considered RMD until the RMD is satisfied. And so there's no way to time it the way he's talking about, just like Jim confirmed. So just always remember that. January 1st is when it's due, and the first thing that's going to come out of there is going to be RMD.
Keep talking because I'm emailing Joe the description I wanted to put in the show notes. Okay. Got any more to say on this?
No, it's just, I'll add a little more that, you know, if you do take it to the next year, that first distribution, also always remember that that following year, you're going to have to take two RMDs because you only get to delay
doing any conversion.
Correct. You're going to owe the RMD in his example for 2026 and the RMD for 2027, both in 2027. So if they're rather large, you're going to have a large income event by pushing it out a year. So you may, just because you can delay it doesn't mean you will want to do it. You want to look at your tax situation. And all of that's going to have to come out before any conversions / rollovers can take place. So you can certainly do a Roth conversion or rollover in the same year that you owe an RMD. It just has to be done after the RMD has been satisfied because of that first dollar out rule. That's what gets people. Some people think they can play games with the timing during the year, and that's just not the case. You don't have that discretion. You have no control over what's considered RMD and what's considered something else. It's all decreed in the tax code, which is a congressional action and then enforced by the IRS.
All righty, perfect. I sent it out to Joe, which was key. What I did, folks, is I got a hold of the EdSlot group and say, hey, could you send me the text? So they got it from the final regulations on required minimum distributions, paragraph F. And they just sent me that paragraph. They didn't send me the entire thing, but it does reference where in the tax code you can find this. If you're going to have to read it a few times, but it all makes sense. And they even address what this gentleman is talking about. They truly do. The last three, four, five sentences address this specific question. It's just that you have to read it a few times because it's English. But it makes no sense. You have to really think through it. Why do people write that way? Why do they write that way? I don't get it. But anyways, it's written in bureaucratic legalese. But if you understand it, you'll be, oh, yeah, you can't do that. And that's what I mean when I say I wish I was a fly on the wall or at least privy to the phone conversation with three different reps. And I'm not throwing Fidelity under the bus. Fidelity's very intelligent. If reps truly did give that information, they don't quite understand it. And I worry they're going to give people the wrong information and people are going to be converting RMDs, which are not allowed, which would be a...
excess contribution to your Roth.
You can't do it. And it would be subject to a 6% penalty. So anyways, it would just be not a good thing. Not the end of the world if you do it.
True.
It'll be unfixed, but you'll end up having to pay some penalties. Although there is a statute of limitations now. I forget if it's 3 years or 6 years. And that's what he's referencing under Secure 2. I can't remember the length of the statute of limitations now. There is no get out of jail free card for before Secure took effect, before this part of Secure 2 took effect. So if they're from the past, they were not grandfathered in. But new mistakes going forward do have a statute of limitations. And again, I forget if it's 3 years or 6 years or somewhere in between. Google can easily answer that for you guys. And I think that's what this gentleman meant. Maybe Secure 2 solved this. No, it didn't get rid of that rule. No. It just means that if you did do this,
and got away with it long enough,
you can get away with it if you don't get caught on it after the statute of limitations, before the statute of limitations, then if they catch you beforehand, yeah, you got to pay the penalties. If they catch it after, you can get out of jail free. But just don't do it and you won't have to worry about that. Yeah. Then his next question, I didn't really look at that. I'm looking at it now. He says, where in all this would a QCD fall? I assume this is before my RMD and a direct donation to the charity. In 2027, I will begin monthly payments for an income annuity that will not satisfy my entire RMDs. Do I then always need to wait until December 1st, my annuity payment year date, to do another conversion to avoid excess RMD that I do not need since the entire RMD was taken out before a Roth conversion can be done? Wow, I'd have to think that through. I can't think that fast.
Yeah, that one gets. We've talked about this a little bit in the past about,
right,
you know, QCDs, which are a separate and independent thing from an RMD, but in some circumstances, it can count towards your RMD. So depending on when you do the QCD for the year, it may or may not contribute to covering your RMD. So it depends on your intentions with it. If you're going to limit your QCD to just what it would take to satisfy the RMD, then you'd want to do some, you know, some looking at what's happening and determine how much will just do that. If you have a certain amount you want a QCD, whether it's satisfying RMD or it goes beyond what your RMD would do, who cares? Doesn't matter, right? There's no law that says you can only give QCD if it's RMD or if it's not RMD. Just matters, you know, based on the order in which dollars come out of your IRA, whether it's going to be counted towards your RMD or not. So
yeah, the big
depends on the circumstances on, you know, what you're trying to accomplish here. If you're not limiting the QCD to some arbitrary RMD amount, then you don't need to worry about it.
But he seems to not want to take out more. I don't know. We had a whole discussion on this with another gentleman's email back and forth.
Yeah.
The big takeaway, and I'm going to answer his question in a minute because I read it a few times. Now it makes sense. I don't know why he even mentioned a QCD because that was immaterial to what the second paragraph is even talking about.
Yeah.
And I'll get to that in a second. The key takeaway, if you have an annuity and you're taking monthly payments, I agree you get more than an annual payment. But if they're coming from an IRA and you're trying to build in QCDs or do conversions, as this gentleman is, monthly payments can screw things up.
Yeah, it gets messy.
And it gets messy. So you have to weigh when you buy a single premium immediate annuity, folks, you are asked by the insurance company, do you want monthly payments or annual payments? And some, not all, but some even give you quarterly payments. If you ask for all your money up front, one annual payment, the fact that the insurance company has to give you all the money right off the bat, they can't leave the majority of it invested and slowly give it to you 1/12 every month throughout the year, you get a little less interest credit because all of your money goes out right away. So you always get more money on a single premium immediate annuity if you take monthly distributions as opposed to an annual.
But you have to wait for them, so there's a trade-off.
Right. It's a trade-off. And when you try to time what this gentleman is doing. So again, I don't know why you mentioned QCDs, because the second paragraph, when I read it a few times, I was like, oh, I know what he's saying. So he says he's fixated now, 2026 is where RMDs begin, but he thinks he has this get out of jail free card. We already said he doesn't, but he's jumping right to 2027. In 2027, I will also begin monthly payments for a qualified income annuity. Mm-hmm. That means it's inside an IRA, folks. That's right. An industry term, qualified. So he's got a qualified income annuity that, and I'm assuming it's an annuity inside an IRA, not a 401k. which is legally the qualified annuity, is inside a 401k, because 401ks are tax qualified accounts under ERISA. Chris and I got into that on a prior show. We won't today. I'm assuming this qualified annuity is inside an IRA, not a 401k. I will begin monthly payments for a qualified income annuity that will not satisfy my entire RMD. So then he says, do I then always need to wait until after December 1st, my last annuity income payment for the year, to do another Roth conversion to avoid taking an excess RMD that I do not need, since the entire RMD needs to be taken before I can do a Roth conversion? What he's asking for here, and not clearly at all, so I could be wrong, but I think he's saying, hey, I'm going to begin receiving payments in 2027 that come on the first of the month. Obviously, the last month of the year is December. So December 1st is my last payment. I'm under the impression, Chris, he's saying all these 12 payments combined are not going to satisfy his RMD.
Right.
And he still wants to do a conversion on top of this. Mm-hmm. So you have a couple of choices, listen.
Yeah.
You take your RMD and just be done with it. But I'm under the impression you don't need much more than your RMD. And if that's the case and you don't want to take more than the RMD, you have to wait to December 1st for the last annuity payment. This is for doing a conversion. You're going to have to wait until December 1st, then figure out what the shortage is, because from your own admission, the very first sentence is, it's not going to satisfy your entire RMD. So let's just say in 2027, December 1st, your last annuity payment comes, and you're still a grand short. I'm making this number up. $1,000 short of your RMD. You're going to have to take on December 1st, 2nd, 3rd, or sometime in December,
or even before that,
RMD.
Yeah.
And then you can do a conversion.
Yeah. Anytime in the year before you do the conversion, you'd have to take the extra $1,000. You don't necessarily have to wait till December 1st, because then as of December 1st, the combination of that extra $1,000 you took plus the annuity payments satisfied your RMD, and then you're open to do a Roth conversion at that point. So since the annuity payments will be a known value and you'll know your RMD that's required, you can figure out how much extra you're going to have to take before doing a Roth conversion before December 1st hits. But if you want to minimize your RMD, what you're forced to take out before you do the conversion, you'll have to figure out what that difference is. In Jim's example, it was $1,000, and make sure that's taken in addition to receiving all of your annuity payments before you do the conversion.
Interesting. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know where the QCD fits into there, and I don't want to go down that rabbit hole on QCDs, because QCDs and income annuities from IRAs, especially on monthly payments, can make the math tracking a little bit difficult, as we've already spoken about. All right, let's get into some other questions. Here's a short one that I think you will act as, it's an annuity question. You are going to, this is going to take you to your instructor days, which still go on as director of financial planning for College State University. You still teach financial planning to your students. Mm-hmm. Let's say, Chris, you are in a classroom. There's no state hint on this. Let's say you're in a classroom and, oh, wait, there is a state hint. I didn't see that. I live in the state that every fall holds a head of the Charles regatta. Is it regatta, regatta?
Regatta. So with the boats.
Well, he lives in, he doesn't give the answer, but I think I know.
Head of the Charles?
Yes.
I'm guessing it's St. Charles River. That's, and the head of that, I don't know, maybe Pennsylvania?
Oh, goodness.
Or something?
No. The Charles River is Boston.
Oh. Okay. I trust you.
Yeah, that song, Dirty Water.
So I guess it's in Massachusetts.
That dirty water. Oh, Boston, you're my home. They talk about the banks of the Charles.
I don't know that one. Sorry.
Okay, that was my attempt at singing, folks, and you won't hear that again. Although for someone, that song is going to be in their head all day and they're going to be really ticked off at me. Okay, let's just assume, Chris, a student of yours raised their hand and said this. Oh, I clicked the wrong email. All right, hold on, folks. We got a technical problem here. There it is. Okay, I thought I deleted the email. Okay, say a kid raises their hand and says, Professor Stein, you Instructor Stein, Professor Stein, Mr. Stein, what do they call you? Yo, dude, what do they call you? Big, tall, bald guy?
Any of those, depending on the day.
Okay, actually, I gave the state hint to some. This gentleman did not send the state. Now we're going to have to answer the actual email that sent that state hint in. I clicked the wrong email. I knew I messed up. Here's the email that I wanted to get to. Let's just say a student of yours raised their hands and said, hey, big, tall, bald guy, let's just say somebody had an annuity that they put $100,000 into and were getting $525 a month for life. How am I going to help them calculate the rate of return? Is it going to be based on any specific age? What if that was a question a student asked you? How would you answer that? Because that is literally the question we received. He did not ask about the Charles River. That was someone else we'll get to next.
Yeah. So it is an answerable question, but essentially what we'd have to solve for is what rate of return would have to apply to that $100,000 that you're putting in to generate $525 a month for, quote, your life, which of course is a certain period of time that we don't know. So we'd have to make some different assumptions. And the length of time you're receiving that $525 every single month will impact what your, quote, rate of return is on that. And generally refer to that in the world of financial planning and finance as the internal rate of return of this, I guess we could call it an investment equivalent, because that's obviously an insurance policy. An annuity is not considered an investment traditionally, but we could certainly solve for this via any number of calculators. And while we'd call it the internal rate of return, we could actually solve for this because we would just be solving for the rate of return on an annuity, because an annuity is a very specific thing in finance and financial planning. You know, in financial planning, we broaden it to the products that the insurance industry refers to as annuities. But in the world of traditional finance, an annuity is a very specific thing, and that is a certain dollar amount received every period, with the dollar amounts all the same and the time between payments all being equal. So $525 a month would be an annuity. $5,000 a year would be an annuity. $10,000 every quarter would be an annuity by traditional finance definitions. And there's actually very simple calculations with a time value of money calculator where we could solve for this. And as I've been, you know, describing this, I've been pulling out my trusty little financial calculator to actually make this determination. So for instance, if you were to put in $100,000 at the beginning of this relationship, we would call that the present value, and then receive $525 every single month. If you were to receive that for 10-year period, so 120 months, you would effectively be in, you know, experiencing a rate of return in this scenario that is negative, which is what you'd assume, because you wouldn't even have gotten your $100,000 back. And actually, you'd have experienced the equivalent of an 8.5% yearly loss, negative rate of return on this. That's at 10 years. But if we did it for 20 years, so 240 months, now that internal rate of return becomes about 2.4% positive. So what that means is if you had $100,000 and earned 2.4% per year, you could take out from that pool of money $525 a month for 240 months and not run out. But then you'd run out. That would be the end of it. If you were alive for 30 years, so you got 360 months worth of payments, now the rate of return, because you've received those payments longer, only putting in the same $100,000, your rate of return grows to about 4.8% per year. in this. And the longer you go, because that means more money is coming back to you compared to the 100,000 you put into it, that rate of return will continue to go up and up and up. So it's dependent on the cash flows and the timing of those cash flows, and how long they happen allows us to solve for the embedded, what we might call it, the rate of return that, we often refer to as the internal rate of return on an investment, or on, in this particular case, an insurance product that we call an annuity. So that's probably how I'd walk them through it, do a little board example, give them a little visual, which we can't do on the podcast here. But if you wanted to do that yourself, you could certainly put these parameters into an online financial calculator, or ask, AI, your favorite AI program, describe the situation to them. But you're going to have to define a length of time, because as I illustrated, how long those payments last has a direct impact on your experienced, quote, rate of return.
And I said it before with the very first question, that if you just tell me the day you die, I'll be able to tell you when to claim Social Security, or Chris could. If you just tell us how long you're going to receive these payments for, in other words, the day you die, assuming this is a lifetime payment, we'll tell you the internal rate of return. Outside of that, does it truly matter? If what you're trying to do, and I get it to all you VG-er mindset of accumulating assets, that's everything, accumulation, crunching numbers, breaking even, not losing, coming out ahead, being the richest person in the graveyard. Don't underappreciate what the annuity is designed to do. And we're going to dedicate an EDU show to a recent, well, I say recent, it actually came out, quote unquote, quite a while ago, but I've been receiving some emails on it now from listeners. I believe it was Blanchett and someone else who did it, although it could have been Fink and someone else, I forget. On the value of lifetime, so I'm glad people are addressing what we've been talking about for years, that people with a lifetime stream of guaranteed income find retirement to be simpler, safer, and they're more inclined to spend money and enjoy themselves. And people who try to live on a withdrawal rate and spend from portfolios spend far less than they could, because they live a more fearful retirement about outliving their money. Don't underappreciate the value that that annuity is going to give you beyond the numbers. It's not all numbers. It's going to be a lifetime stream of guaranteed income, that bottomless cup of coffee that you can never stop getting at the cafe that serves bottomless cups of coffee. You can just drink coffee to your heart's content. Although if you're a man in the early 60s like me and you're trying to drink a large iced coffee right before doing a long flight, you're going to be getting up and going to the men's room several times on the plane, as I did yesterday, questioning again, why do I always buy a large Dunkin' Donuts iced coffee and drink it and bring it onto the plane before taking off? But anyways, I digress. Don't underappreciate the simplicity and the ability to feel comfortable living in retirement, spending your money freely. As you age and don't understand financial concepts, you'll always understand the safe money coming in, the peace of mind knowing your minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare is fully covered. All of those, to me, far more important factors. Not to mention, under Secure 2, the ability to help control RMDs, which we won't get into, but needs to also be put into this calculation. All these non-quantifiable, but in my opinion, far more important considerations than what the hell am I going to get out of this? Because you don't know, as Chris just showed you. Are you going to live one day? Are you going to live 40 years? While Chris was chatting, someone we know from society just died at 97. My neighbor was over getting some onions and some corn and some cucumbers and some leeks from, in exchange for eggs, from my garden. And Chris, if you want any of that stuff that I just mentioned, I'll bring it into you next week. And she was telling me about her partner, well, her wife's mother, who's 103 and lives right down the road in Longmont and still lives alone. And here's the scary part. drives 103. I don't know what the internal rate of return of her annuity would have been if she bought one at 60.
Probably pretty healthy.
Does it matter?
Right.
That's my point. You VGers, I love yous. But sometimes your mindset clouds everything. It's not about how much you're going to get. It's about all these other elements I'm trying to describe and get you guys to understand. So I do thank people who sent me either articles that indirectly tied to this research report, and a couple of you actually sent the research report. That's going to be an EDU show, two-parter most likely, in the not-too-distant future. Chris and I are going to finish up with another article that someone sent us as a second EDU show next week. And I still hope to get some guests coming on. So exciting EDU shows coming up. But I loved it because there's so much more to this than just like the Social Security question of break even. Who cares? You're dead. Instead, look at all the other things that don't go into this internal rate of return calculation Chris just described. All these other equally important but difficult to quantify financially value of a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. Okay, I need to get to this last question. It's going to be, well, it's actually more, but I don't know if Chris is going to let us go on. Only because we read his hint. So here's the actual guy who sent the hint about the Charles River Regatta. Hi, Jim and Chris. I have a quick question. Don't let me answer it, Chris. I have a quick question. Don't even come in and bother saying that, folks, about annuities. I have a quick question about annuities. I'm 72, and my secure income fully covers my minimum dignity floor right now. But I can see in time, due to inflation, that's not going to be the case. He just described the what point, Chris?
Crossover point, where initially your secure income satisfies your minimum dignity floor, and oftentimes, and then some. So maybe some of your fun expenses, but because it doesn't either doesn't grow at all or doesn't grow as fast as inflation on your minimum dignity floor eventually catches up to and surpasses the secure income. And it's when that surpasses, we call that the crossover point, because if you look at it on a graph over time, it's literally two lines that cross over. That after that, then he'll be short. And if he's got a goal of covering his minimum dignity floor with secure income, he'll need more secure income at that point.
Right. He continues. I was wondering when the time comes for me to buy a single premium immediate annuity, where is the best place for me to take my money from? My traditional IRA, my Roth IRA, or my brokerage account? Thanks, and he gives his real name. We'll call him George. George, I can answer this with two words or three words.
Yeah.
And my two-word answer, it depends. Mm-hmm. My three-word answer, I don't know. It depends. That's technically five words.
Yeah.
At the time, you will decide. Do not try to pigeonhole. And I know that's hard because of my belief in investment positioning. And that we try to pull the dollars that the older you is going to need. I'm hoping you're doing all this calculation. We generally, as our default, will put it in the IRA as the reserve. If the client, if we're working with someone, has enough money inside the IRA to cover the reserve that our calculation indicates they need to have. And we usually discount that reserve 3%, so it's not a massive discount rate. But we'll leave enough money aside, assuming it will grow at 3%. And the reason we use a low assumed rate of return, the very least, we want to make sure we can earn that. I feel fairly confident during the delay period we'll earn that, preferably more. Because if we discount it down too much, oh, gee, stocks have averaged this. I'm going to discount it 7, 8, 9%. My portfolio for the last decade has been on fire. I'm wonderful. I'm brilliant when it comes to investing. Well, if you do that, you run the very real risk you're not going to have enough money in the future. So we would rather discount it at a smaller level. I know as our knee-jerk reaction when we work with people we work with. We try to, Jacob and I try to put that reserve inside an IRA, especially post-secure 2, because the payment from that single premium annuity, if you did annuitize inside the IRA, is going to be significantly greater than the RMD, even if you have to do this in your late 70s or 80s. By then, the RMD is going to be about 5 or so percent of your IRA, but the distribution for somebody at 80 from an annuity is probably closer to 9, 10, or 11 percent, significantly greater than the RMD. So that excess payment can allow you, can be applied now to your RMDs of the non-annuitized IRA, allowing that account to continue to grow. Maybe add some inflationary protection in there. If you don't need the money, you don't have to take it out. You're not going to be forced to take it out. So we now, post-secure 2, kind of default to that. But we warn clients, the ultimate decision is going to come down to, first of all, do you have money in a Roth? Do you have money inside a brokerage? And do you have money inside an IRA? If so, we'll decide in the future. And we the positions. We always tell people your position is etched in jello, not in stone. And if you do have money in a Roth in the future, but for one reason or another, it makes undeniable sense to annuitize the Roth, we annuitize the Roth. Or maybe it's a mixture of two. Hey, I should take 40% of my payment tax-free from the Roth and 60% from the annuity. From the IRA. In other words, there's nothing you can do today to decide. It's the older you that's going to make the decision. You just need to make sure the reserve is there. We default as a knee-jerk reaction to doing it inside the IRA because of Secure 2, but the ultimate decision is made in the future. What says you, Chris?
Yeah, and I think the tendency is to look to the IRA because if you look in the future when you're having RMDs, if the RMDs are going to be forced upon you anyway, if you're taking it out anyway, why not have it be annuity payments, right? If they're needed to cover the minimum dignity floor, because you have to take them out anyway, the fact that it's an annuity payment only has advantages. It's coming out when it would have had to come out anyway. And it's also getting this favorable treatment as far as, you know, potentially offsetting other RMDs that you might have to take on other dollars outside of the annuity. So I think for a lot of people that if they do some projections and look at their likely RMD sizes, if they're well in excess of what that annuity payment would be, why not turn a chunk of that RMD into secure income? It just makes sense, right? It's, you know, for other people where the potential annuity payment they need is well in excess of the RMD, then, you know, because their RMDs aren't particularly large overall, and they've got maybe a really big minimum dignity floor or something like that, then it takes a little more scrutiny. But I think what I tend to see in the projections is a lot of support for the IRA being the source of the future secure income generation, since it would, for a lot of people, end up having to come out as RMDs anyway.
Exactly. And if you have to take it, you might as well apply it to the RMDs, and you might be able to reduce post-secure too your RMDs right. from non-annuitized IRA. So right. I agree. That's why I said that. Yeah. Do we have time for more or not?
No, we probably shouldn't launch into another one unless it's a three-word answer or something like that, which is highly unlikely for this show. I don't think it's possible to answer a question in three words on this show.
At least I just did. I don't know, or it depends.
But then you made the mistake of continuing to talk. Which is what we should do.
I threw it over to you. I threw it over to you.
Which is what people want to hear. The why, right? Why do you say it depends? Well, let me just share that with you. So, yeah, that'll have to wrap us for today. And then, yeah. Unless you have anything else to say, we'll bail here. I'll tell people how they can send in a question to the show if they're interested.
You know, theoretically, Chris, I could answer this question, it'll be yes, yes, no, yes. It's
and you
this,
can,
this is the answer.
And you can leave it for that with that without any expansion.
We theoretically
expanding?
Could. So here it is. We'll skip the state hint.
Okay.
Even though the answer was Kentucky, according to him, the Iroquois Indian word for Kentucky means land for tomorrow, and it was pronounced Kentatin, and it became Kentucky. I don't know if that's true or not. He asks this. It's a rule of 55 question. I left employment for my company A when I was 55, and I could withdraw from my previous employer's 401k without penalty. Yeah. I am not 59 and a half yet. But after a short period of unemployment, I decided, After a short period of unemployment, I decided to go back to work for a different company, and I now have a new 401k. I never rolled over my old 401k into my new 401k. Even though I'm now employed at Company B, can I still make penalty-free withdrawals under the rule of 55 from my previous employer's 401k if I so choose to continue to do so?
Yes.
If yes, can you please continue? Okay, listener. If I then leave Company B, can I make penalty-free withdrawals from both 401ks? Yes. Assuming, I don't know how close to 59 and a half you are. You're either 4.5 years away or less. Assuming there's enough money in it, yes. If yes, continue on. Okay. Is there a limit to the number of 401ks I could do this with? Well, I don't know how many jobs you're going to try to get before 59 and a half, but the answer to that is no.
No limit.
Do as many times as you want.
Yep.
If no, can you continue on? If yes, continue on. Well, no. The answer is no, but I'll continue on. Does starting withdrawals at any particular time of year matter? No, legally, no. Just no. So there's your answer. I told you you could do it.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, no, no.
Yeah.
Or I don't know.
Pretty clean.
Number four. See, okay. Quick and harmless.
Perfect. Okay. So we did get to a fifth one. With that said, if you want to send in your own question, probably won't be answered as succinctly as that. But send in those questions to Jim directly. Jim@jimhelps.com is the email. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Put in the subject line. It's a question for the podcast and include a couple words about the topic. I did hear through the grapevine that we are not depleted, but running a little low on Social Security questions. So if you've been holding back, sending in a Social Security question, open the floodgates and
what? Chris, in reference to that, why don't you share with listeners what you shared with me on the disability ones? We've got, if we count all the disability ones we have a lot of Social Security questions.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I think the source of most of those are not podcast listeners per se, but rather people who find us searching for help on Social Security. And of course, most of you know that we have a website called helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. Which is really meant for, you know, help with my Social Security retirement benefits.com, I guess is probably what we should have registered. But people are seeking, because of the complexities and the hurdles in getting Social Security disability, a lot of answers to their questions about that. And that's not our area of expertise. So certainly if it's a blended question where you happen to be on Social Security disability now, but then it's transitioning to a retirement benefit and how that might work. But if it's Social Security disability focused, that is, again, not our area of expertise. There's some quite a bit of complexity to that. I know a fair amount about it, but it's really not in line with the theme of the show here. So we're probably not going to do many, if any, dedicated Social Security disability questions. We have touched on a few of those in the past, but, people listen to the Retirement and IRA show for retirement topics, which, I guess you could have those transitionary ones, but if you have a specific disability question, that's probably best for. There's plenty of blogs out there and legal offices, lawyers that provide support specifically for Social Security disability, and they'd be more experts in that to answer those questions. So thought we'd share that with everyone. But yeah, send me your retirement Social Security questions and survivor benefits, spousal benefits, all that kind of stuff. We love to get those. So there's some openings coming up with those topic areas. If you've been holding back, go ahead and send them our way, jim@jimhelps.com. So Jim, you have a good weekend. Hope your garden has somewhat done well with all the heat. And I look forward to putting in my order for fresh produce. And everyone else, take care. And we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jim, H-E-L-P-S.com, or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.